Blog Talk Radio.
Chatting with Sherry is presented by the Writers and Illustrators of the Future. They have been providing a means for new and budding writers to have a chance for their creative efforts to be seen and acknowledged. Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. I'm really excited because we're bringing back a lovely author from Australia. Her name is Karen Warren. She's written a few books. The latest one is Tide of Stone. And this is a recorded interview, so please don't call in. Here's Karen. Oh, there's a delay. Bear with me. Well, Karen will be with us in just 1 minute. You know, Blog Talk, we have issues. While we're waiting for the computer to catch up with my interview, I do have some announcements. My show will not be on Thursday because it's the 4th of July. And it will be back for your enjoyment and your pleasure next week on the 11th.
Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Sherry.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, how are you?
Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Sherry.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm really happy to have you back.
I'm really happy to do that too. I was actually with Lee Murray when you were chatting to her, and I'm like, oh, I want to talk to Sherry again.
Aww, I love talking to Lee.
I know. Well, I was listening. I was actually in her office with her when she was chatting to you, and I was just enjoying it so much. So I said, I want to talk to Sherry again. I love talking to Sherry. So much fun. And we had such an interesting, such an interesting conversation I always have with you.
That's because I don't stick to any scripts.
I love that. That's the best conversation.
I just like to, chat.
Yeah.
For my guests who don't know you, Karen, can you tell a little bit about yourself?
So I'm an Australian writer of horror and science fiction and crime recently. I've been getting into crime as well. I write novels and short stories.
You're writing crime stories? I didn't know that.
What's that?
I didn't know you were writing crime stories.
Yeah, well, the novel that I'm just about to finish is much more of a crime story than previously. In fact, I think when we were chatting last year, I was on my residency in Perth. I had that 3-week writing residency, and I was finishing off the first draft of this novel then. So I can't remember if I talked a little bit about it or not. But I let it sit for 6 months or so, and now I'm just getting back into just doing my second draft and tying up all the loose ends and doing a very exhaustive timeline to make sure that all my dates are right and finding out that I've made someone 5 years older than they should have been, or called someone a granddaughter when they should be a daughter, and all that sort of stuff you have to do when you're doing a complex novel. It's fun though, I'm kind of enjoying it, but I'm also I'm really glad I'm doing this, because there's so many little errors that I've made here and there, errors of timing, etc.
That's
really done, and I just need to figure out a few little twists and turns, and then we'll be just about good to go, I think.
That's always fun. Yeah, I'm actually writing a mystery myself.
Ah.
Yeah, it's really different.
Yeah. Well, you've got to do it. Writing horror and science fiction is a different kind of thing. You have to, you can get away with not having a perfect crime, I guess, or a perfectly written crime. But if you're writing crime, that crime has to be spot on, doesn't it?
Uh-huh.
You have to have a proper solution, etc. So I'm not having, in this one I don't want to have ghosts in there, and I don't want to have any mysterious sort of answers to what's going on. I'm trying to keep it fairly real. Although it is set in an old house where they run ghost tours through. So I've kind of got the concept of ghosts in there, if not real ghosts. Yeah, but knowing that you've got to have, if there's a crime, there has to be some kind of a solution that isn't just, you know, oh, it was the ghost that did it, or, you know, some. You can't have any cheats if you're writing a mystery novel, can you? You can't cheat on the ants.
I have the mystery's solid. The mystery I'm writing is really solid, but the way it's being done is really different, and actually there is a ghost in my story. But the ghost is not... The ghost is more of like a psychic.
Yeah. Well, that's fine, though. You know what I mean, though? Like, if your mystery is solid, then that's what the reader wants. Like, the reader doesn't want to get to the end and find out that it was all a dream, or it was all the ghost talking, or something like that. They want to have that satisfying mystery solution. So if that part's solid, then I think you can do whatever else you want for the rest of it.
You don't want a Dallas thing.
No, oh my God.
I thought that was...
Disappointed with people by that. I was disappointed.
That was real cheeky, that one, I mean, really.
Yeah.
I didn't even watch Dallas, but I was curious like everybody else in the world because it was such a big deal. You know, when, I forgot the, it's JR's brother, right?
Yeah, Bobby.
Bobby, yeah. And he's in the shower, and it's all a dream.
Oh my gosh. I know. How could they have done that in good conscience, honestly? And it was like 2 seasons or something they wiped out, wasn't it?
Yes.
What?
Yeah, it's like none of it happened. It was 2 years of show, and none of it happened.
None of it happened. Terrible.
I bet all
they do that a lot in TV shows now, where something will happen and then you go, oh no, that bit was a dream. And quite often that's like, I'm interested in that, what was happening, and then they go back to what isn't a dream, and I'm like, no, I'm bored now. Actually, can you go back, can you make a cartwheel, please? It's kind of annoying. I don't like that little trick.
I really do like the new Sherlock series with Ben Cumberbatch, but, you know, the part where he jumped off the building and they had like 4 endings and they never really told you what happened.
Right.
That annoyed me.
Yeah, I haven't actually watched it, but I did read about this just recently, how they were trying to recapture the Holmes falling into the falls, and how outraged all the readers were at the time, and so Conan Doyle had to bring him back to life, you know. It was like a year or 2 years later he had to bring him back to life. So I guess they were sort of jumping in and doing it before there was the outrage about Holmes being killed off.
Yeah, but at least Doyle gave you 2 solid things. The first was the fake, where you think he's dead, and then how he survived, and an actual explanation of how he survived. This was really, they were all ridiculous. None of it makes sense.
Right. So that's what I meant about getting the mystery, having the mystery solid. You have to have that mystery solid. You can't say, this is what I'm writing, but I'm not going to do it properly.
Yeah, that's not right.
It's more confining, but it's lots of fun at the same time.
Yeah, I'm actually, isn't it fun? I haven't written, my first one was sort of like a crime drama that I wrote that's sort of been a mystery thing, but this is the first real mystery that I've ever written for one of my novels. I've written short stories and stuff, but I've never written an actual book. And you know what?
Yeah, right.
I'm having fun.
Yeah, oh good. Gosh, it's the long game, isn't it, when you're writing a book? You're sort of writing stuff now that you won't actually get to for another 5 or 6 months or whatever. You know, you're planning stuff ahead and... It's a lot of fun. A lot more work than a short story. The thinking that goes into a short story is a lot, don't you find?
Oh, yeah.
Like the planning of a short story. I'm working on one at the moment for an anthology that brings together the planets or the... mine's actually an asteroid, and the gods or the goddesses that they were named for, and talking about the influences of both. And that's taken so much research and so much thinking.
Oh, that sounds cool.
And then it's only going to be like a 2,000 or 3,000 word short story.
That sounds really cool.
Yeah, it's been interesting. I'm doing the asteroid Pallas, and Pallas Athena is the goddess, is the combination. And then at the same time, I was researching about the metal palladium, which is this beautiful-looking stuff and has all sorts of associations with protection and all sorts of things. So I'm kind of bringing three elements into this story, which is very complicated, but I think I'm nearly there. But I was just visiting, as I said, I was in New Zealand just recently, and hanging out with Lee Murray a little bit, and we went to Rotorua, which is where all the hot mud is and the geysers, and it's just this amazing, absolutely amazing sort of prehistoric place in some areas. And so that's influenced this story as well. I kind of woke up in the middle of the night two nights ago and said, I've got to set it in Rotorua. And that was my answer. You know, that was my final little part of the puzzle. I couldn't quite figure out how it was going to work. And then I went, oh, my gosh, how could I not set it in Rotorua?
That's really cool.
Oh, it's amazing, this place. You walk along and there is hot mud, like burning hot mud bubbling up. But they have it all fenced off so you don't accidentally put your foot in it or whatever.
That's a good idea.
Yes, it's a very good idea. And lots of, and of course they tap into the artesian water, which is hot as anything. So one place we stayed, they'll fill the tub. It's constantly refilling. But they have to leave it in a tank for 24 hours before they fill it into the bathtub because it's so hot. And even after 24 hours, it's still at a really high temperature. Like, I think it was 38 Celsius, which I'm not sure what that is. Fahrenheit, I'll have to look that up, but it's still really, really hot. Like, you've got to sort of dip your toe in it and slowly, but it's, oh, I just love it. It just makes you feel so good.
That's weird.
Beautiful area. If you ever get to New Zealand, you'll have to make sure you get there. Cool. And Worldcon's in New Zealand next year.
I wish I could. I really do. I've been invited to New Zealand, Australia so many times, like, by people, gotta come, and I'm like, yeah, I'll be there when I can.
Well, look, if you can come next year to Worldcon, you should try to, because it's going to be big, but you should come anyway.
I wish.
And it was all cheaper and closer, it would be much easier.
Yeah, I have a shower curtain that's a world map, and one day I was talking to someone, I went into the bathroom to take a shower, and I looked at where California is and where Australia and New Zealand is, and I'm going, yeah, so that's how far away it is. Okay.
Yeah. Well, at least on that side, though, it takes longer when you've got to get over to the east side.
Yeah.
That's true. It has to be a little bit longer. But, yeah, it's about, like, door-to-door for me, it's about 30 hours, something like that, to get. So my last trip to America, my first stop was New Jersey. So door-to-door from where I live in Canberra to New Jersey, I think was 32 hours, something like that, of travel.
That's a long trip.
It is a long way.
And he ended up in...
It's less if you stop at the East Coast, because, you know, you don't have that five-hour flight, and then, you know, getting to New Jersey was another hour and a half from New York, so, yeah.
And he ended up in Jersey.
Oh, yes, I did. Well, look, I've got my sister lives there, so I always try and spend at least a week with her because I miss her so much.
Don't
I get my hair done. She's got this amazing hairdresser that does. I get my hair done whenever I go there. Oh my gosh, she's so good. I wish I was rich enough I could just fly over and get my hair done by her every time. She does. She's just a really brilliant colorist and. Takes about 5 hours, so I've got to make sure I've, you know, got snacks with me or whatever.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, but...
Where in New Jersey? Where in New Jersey? Because I used to live there, just curious.
In Flemington.
Is that northern New Jersey?
I don't really know. Sorry.
Oh, it's okay.
I haven't quite figured out what's where. It's in quite a farmy kind of area, so there's lots of greenery around.
Yeah, it sounds like northern.
Yeah, very nice, like really, really lovely.
I used to live in an area near Princeton. It's called Brunswick.
Oh, okay, yes. I think I might have even, I have caught the train from New Brunswick, I believe. Is it called New Brunswick or Brunswick?
Brunswick, I think.
Brunswick,
it could be
yeah,
New I Brunswick. I was 10 or 11, so I don't remember really well.
I caught the train, so I spent one night in Princeton. I had relatives who live in Princeton, so I caught the train from Princeton to Washington. Once I'd done my New Jersey bit and my New York bit, I caught the train from Princeton to Washington.
And you know what they call New York and New Jersey, right? They don't call it New York and Manhattan. They call it the city.
The city, yeah.
Because there's no other city but New York.
No, that's right. It's the city.
I remember being a transplant from first Ohio and then California. And I was saying that my brother and my parents were going to be going into Manhattan. And I said, Manhattan. Oh, you're going to the city. Yeah, that's what Manhattan is. It's the city.
Well, there's so many parts of the city, too.
Yeah.
Like, which part are you going to? Are you going to Manhattan? Is only Manhattan the city? Like, what about Brooklyn? Is that considered the city as well?
Brooklyn is a borough of New York. It's not really... My dad's from Brooklyn.
Okay, yeah.
So it's considered... It's New York, and New York City is five boroughs. So it is part of the city, but Manhattan is one of... That's the central part. That's where all the, you know, it's where Broadway is, where Wall Street
yeah.
is, Golden Gate.
So when people say the city, they just mean Manhattan.
Manhattan.
They don't mean
yeah.
the boroughs as well.
They don't mean the boroughs. They just mean yeah. Manhattan. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. They're not going to Bronx. They're not going to Brooklyn.
Yeah. I had one night in Brooklyn, which was really fun. And had some friends, I stayed with friends in Brooklyn, which I hadn't been out there before. It was cool. It was a little different version of New York City that I hadn't seen before. I usually stayed in Manhattan and right in the centre.
I wasn't allowed.
You wasn't allowed to go into the city?
No, I wasn't allowed to go to Brooklyn.
Oh, right.
Because when I was a little girl, when the period of time that we lived back east, New York wasn't exactly in its best way. They
yeah.
were going through a difficult growing period, shall we say.
Okay. Yeah.
And my dad didn't want us he didn't want us to even go near Brooklyn. And Brooklyn's cleaned up and it's beautiful and it's got all the it's become the village now the way it is. It's totally different. But when I was a little girl, and this was a long time ago, yeah, he didn't want to expose his children to Brooklyn, even though he was
yeah,
raised
right.
there.
Well, you know, my early exposure to New York City and all the area, all the boroughs, etc., was from Mad Magazine, I'm just thinking. Like various different jokes and Dave Berg and all of those cartoonists writing cartoons about New York is what when I first heard about it. And it was always about violence and people being robbed and all that sort of thing. So that was my first impression of it, was a kind of scary place to be.
That's, and Manhattan wasn't as bad, but did you ever see a show called Barney Miller?
Yes.
That is
yes.
a perfect rendition of what New York was at that period.
Yeah, I don't remember it all that well. It's been a long time since I've seen it.
But it's all in humor. But that's if you watch that show and it has all the stuff that's going on in New York at that time, it shows it very accurately. Obviously,
yeah.
they lived there before they moved
okay,
to L.A.
Yeah, right. Well, look, it's definitely changed a lot. By the time I first got to visit it, it was already a much more different place to go visit than Mad Magazine gave me any indication of.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, yeah, Mad Magazine's a humor magazine anyway.
Yeah.
We're at the halfway point, so do you want to tell about your book?
So the most recent one has just been winning a couple of awards. It's Tide of Stone. That was, I think, not released, or was just about to be released last time I was chatting to you.
Uh-huh.
So this is the one that Lee Murray edited and published by Kate Jones at Omnium Gatherum. And it's been doing really well. So it's just won the Aurealis Award and won the Australian Shadows Award, and it's shortlisted for the Locust Awards, which are on this weekend, but unfortunately I can't come over to America again. But I've asked a friend to, in the unlikely chance of win. So I have learned that you do need to be prepared for these things, because even if you think you're not going to win, you've got to have someone there ready just in case. Have it pulled just in case.
It's like the Oscars.
Yes, that's right. So that's set in a time ball tower, which is actually a real thing. They used to use it a long time ago to the ships at sea would keep time by these towers, where a ball is drawn up at a particular time. Depends on, sometimes it's 3 minutes to noon, and sometimes it's, I think, 5 minutes to one. Like, it just depends. I don't know why they changed. But this ball would be drawn up, and it would drop at exactly noon. And so people out at sea would be able to see this and reset their clocks, or make sure their clocks are set to local time. But I just love this idea of time passing, and seeing this visual representation of time passing, like a ticking clock, I guess, but something that's just, and there's another day gone, and another day's gone, and another day's gone. And that's the main setting. And on that time ball tower are prisoners who have been given immortality. So there's a sort of people that, when you hear people talking about a terrible crime, people say that death is too good for them and life in prison is too good for them. What would be worse than that? What's a worse fate than death? And my fate that I invented is immortality, except that their bodies get old and their minds get old, and they are kind of left sitting there shriveling up for all eternity. So yeah, it's very nasty, but it explores a lot about crime and punishment and why we feel the need to punish, and does that actually help anybody, all that sort of thing. And partly, well, a lot inspired, like the setting on the inside at least, with the people lined up and just getting old and being ignored to a large extent, was inspired a lot by visits to old people's home, and in particular high-level dementia wards, where people are sort of put there and their relatives will come and see them, and they're cared for, they're physically looked after, but they're long since capable of doing the sort of things that you and I, Sherry, have been talking about beforehand, about having conversations and making connections and forming new relationships. They're long since past that. And what's left is just these physical renditions of a person who eats when food is put there, and, can sometimes respond to things, but not really, and just have, what a terrible thing this is, and how it happens to so many people and so many friends I have. And I've got a friend or, a relative who's in a similar circumstance. How many people are in this circumstance, and how many have loved ones in this circumstance, and how hard it is for all involved.
Horrible.
Yeah, so that's partly what inspired the feeling of what happens inside this time ball tower. And how, when you go there, they're quite often given one photo to represent their lives. So outside their door or by their bed, there'll be a photo that is to, I can see the idea of it, it's to humanise them and to make sure the people who are caring of them remember that there was a person before this old person. But it's just, how do you choose one single thing to represent you? Like, somebody will have them holding a cat. Somebody will have them standing by their boat or by their car, or somebody else is there with their family, when they were young, their wedding photo, that sort of thing. But to choose one thing to represent you for your entire life is kind of devastating as well, I suppose.
That is. Yeah, you made me think of something. When I used to go out with some older family members, totally together, very intelligent, with it people, it's weird how a little gray hair makes people treat you like you don't understand English or something.
Yes.
It is the most they're completely competent, live their own lives, have their own place, everything. And yet they're treated, when they go to a restaurant or a department store, like they're mentally unfit to do this.
Yes.
It annoys me so much. Well, like, yes. It makes me angry.
Yes. No, exactly. And why is that? I don't know. But I still dye my hair because I'm just not ready to be that, you know. I know my hair would be probably fully grey when I'm just in my early 50s. My hair would be fully grey. And I know that I would be treated differently because I am treated differently if I don't dye it for a little bit. People definitely have a different opinion of you, which is, you know, it's not good. But I'm not willing to fight society on that one yet, so I am playing the game. But it totally happens. No, it totally does happen. And that's exactly the sort of thing I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You forget that these people have lived incredible lives, you know.
And that's another thing.
And even the ones who have had quiet lives have lived lives full of decision-making and keeping themselves and other people alive and all these things, and then they get grey hair and they get a little bit slower on their feet, and the assumption is that they don't understand anything.
That's another thing that annoys me, is that, sorry, your book is wonderful. I'm just thinking about the things you're saying, and it's just...
Oh, yeah, no, and that's what it's meant to be. It's meant, any sort of writing should be about starting conversations, even if they're about something completely, you know, a segue.
But it's just like... How can you have people who are, even people who are close to other people, not want to know what the life story is of your mom, your dad, your grandparents? I don't understand that. How can you not want to know?
Yes.
It's part of you. How can you not want to know about this stuff?
No, that's right. And well, because you see that person as... in the moment they're with you and in their relationship to you, and I think it's hard for people to understand or to accept that they lived a whole other life before that.
Mm-hmm.
Like they had a whole other existence, you know. They're not just mum, they're mum who, you know, did well at school or didn't do well at school and then had these adventures and travelled overseas, and people exist in the moment they are in that moment, I suppose. But no, I'm totally with you. We should know their stories. We should know their life stories.
Yeah, I mean, I know my mom. Well, my mom's passed on, but I know her very well. And when she told me a story about an adventure that she had before she met my dad, I wasn't surprised. It was completely part of her personality. But
yes.
And I loved it because it was fun and it was her and it was funny and it was adventurous and stuff like that. But I was telling one of my girlfriends about it. This was several years ago. And she said, "Your mom did that, but she seems such like a nice, quiet lady."
Yeah.
So my mom is a nice, quiet lady, but she was a young girl at that time.
Yes. But do you have this feeling that you kind of look back at you as a young child and as a teenager, and it's like there's a separation? Do you feel a separation between yourself now and yourself back there?
Oh, yeah.
Or do you feel a continuity between it all?
Both. I do. Yeah. I feel both, but it depends what my mood is.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting, though? Like, you would think, when you're living the moment, and I've said to my daughter in particular, like, you're living this moment now, but it's going to be a time in the future. Well, this is a memory. This will be not your lived time, but a memory that you will actually feel weirdly separate, separate to. And it's hard to think of that when you're living the moment, but it does happen. There's a time separation happens. You can remember it really well, but it does feel like it does actually feel like a different you to a certain extent.
But it is a different you. I mean, we change every 7 years.
Yes.
Not just physically, but emotionally, mentally, our experiences, everything. Everything, you are separated by your life. But it is continuity, too, because it is your life, and you can see the string of what happened to you and why you're like this and why things are like this for you, because you're constant and you know. But it's still separate because, like I said, you grow.
I mean,
we're not stagnant.
No, I know. Well, you'd hope. You don't want to be.
No.
No.
I don't. Last thing I want to be is stagnant.
No, that's just terrible.
Yes.
That's it.
Now that's a punishment. That would be a punishment.
Yeah. Yes. So I guess these are kind of, this is what's happening to these people who are locked in the tower. They are stagnant. There's no learning. There's no new information. They're not really forming. They're kind of forming relationships with each other, but not really. So that's part of what the punishment is, that there's no movement, there's no growth, there's no change. Terrible.
That's awful. Terrible. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, but
cruel.
I think it's really important for people to learn from this, what you're talking about, and accept that everybody, your family, your friends, everybody has lived a life. You don't really, and this is something I find really interesting, I don't know if you do, people know each other very well, if you're family or your best friend or whatever, but you really don't. You only know what you're given.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There is an inner part of every single person that's private.
Yes.
And so you shouldn't assume. You know what I mean?
No, that's right. And even the people who appear to be completely open and themselves, they too have that little secret self. I totally believe.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think you can be alive and human and living and a thinking person without having this private little area. I mean, if you don't have an imagination and you don't have inner thoughts, you're also stagnant.
Yes. Yes. But I guess most people do. Like, even if they're not, you know, deep inner thoughts, I think everybody must have, and they must, everyone must have some kind of, Some kind of other self that resides inside them.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the perfect self or anything like that.
No, I'm not talking about that.
It's the pure self, maybe.
It's more like the inner workings of you.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. You open up the computer and it's the inner workings.
Yeah. It's really interesting.
I don't know why it popped into my head, but it did.
Yeah, no, I really like that. I like that a lot. I actually, in my other, I've got a short story collection out at the moment called The Primer, Karen Warren from Dark Moon Books. And in that, Eric Gernard, who's the editor and the publisher, he asked me just to write an autobiography. And I think what he just wanted was, he wanted, you know, a couple of thousand words he said I could have. But I ended up doing almost a confession of my secret self, not quite, but almost, calling it my shadow self, talking about the self that you have that the world sees, and then there's the shadow self, which is the other stuff that goes on, and the, you know, not always secrets, but exactly that kind of thing that you're talking about.
It doesn't have to be.
Being a writer, like, my writer self was a shadow self for a long time because where I went to school, people didn't really admire anything academic. You were laughed at if you were smart. Like, it wasn't a particularly good school that I went to. You were laughed at for being smart. So I pretended that I wasn't a writer. I told one or two really good friends, but being a writer was my shadow self for a long time. Yes, until I finally realised I could do it. So, yeah, so that article or that little story is about the kind of thing that you're talking about. It's very interesting, Sherry.
Yeah, it is really interesting. It's not actually secret. It's more private. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It's a fine line, but there's a difference.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. It's hard to express. Like, it's kind of private and hard to express.
Yeah.
Like, if you had to say what was in that place, I think it would be very hard to find words.
It's just like, you know, when you're working on a story and see, and most writers are like this. I'm sure you are, because we both are, because we've talked about it. When you're working through a story, there's no timeline for when you're working on a story. It's when it pops into your head. It's like. You've got an outline. You know basically what you want, but the characters basically tell you what they want to do and where they want to go and how they want to work it. And people don't get that, but it's true.
Yes, no, it is true.
That is part of the private thing that's going on in my head. I mean, I don't say these things out loud. I don't talk. I mean, except in a conversation like this, and even then I don't go into specifics, but it's there. I mean, and you have a sort of compartmentalized, like there's my writer's part of my brain, and then there's my private life kind of my brain, and there's my worrying part of my brain. I'm very complex.
That worrying part and that little panic, the panic part of the brain when someone shouts and you're like, are you okay? Are you okay? You know, or I smelled smoke. I worked 2 days a week in a secondhand shop, and there was these protests out the front. We've got this terrible, terrible mine that the government has just signed off on that people don't want, so there was a protest out the front there. So it was very noisy, and someone was playing music, and people were shouting, and I suddenly smelt smoke. And I'm like, what's that smoke? Where's that smoke? And everyone's like, oh, where's the smoke? And then someone said, no, it's okay, it's outside. But there's that moment of panic. Like, that was just a total panic part of my brain. I knew I had to say the words quickly to make sure everyone was alert to it. But whether or not me panicking was going to help everybody get out safely or just panic everybody. But everyone kind of froze. It was really interesting. I said, where's that smoke coming from? And the whole shop, there was probably, I don't know, 20 people in the shop at least. Everybody froze. Everybody looked around, and then someone identified it was outside. It was quite interesting.
Because that's the animal part of ourselves. That's the part.
Yeah.
That's the part that protects us. People don't realize it. We don't want to shed the animal portion, because the animal portion is what protects us. It's very important.
Yeah.
And that's, again, another layer of privacy that's inside of us, but it's part of everybody. Everybody has that fight or run impulse that's very famous. That's part of it. That's animal. That's
totally.
Yeah.
And this freeze, like, we all, the fact that everybody froze and we all looked, you know, all of a sudden we're just observing. It was fascinating, and luckily it was outside. So I'm thinking, oh my gosh, how are we all going to get out of this shop if it's inside? Where is it? Like, the shop is full of treasures. I couldn't bear the thought of them all burning down, but luckily that was, the protesters were doing something outside. But yeah, it was really interesting.
And there's
also, and talking about, that's the panic part of my brain, or the, you know, the animal part, animal response part of my brain went, where's that smoke coming from? And really loudly, and everyone, you know, it was just so interesting.
And it's just like disasters, like major earthquakes. I've been through several of those. And your brain is like that freezing part, and then analyzing. And then you go do whatever you are going to do. But
because you need that time, you need to freeze your body. Like, your body, you haven't even got control over that freezing. Your body stops, your brain stops your body moving, so it's got time to figure out what to do.
I read that the brain actually makes your arms and legs stop for a minute.
Yeah,
it just freezes you.
Yeah.
Your brain does that. It's not any. It's not even your body doing it. It's your
brain shutting it down, saying, don't move until I figure this out, please.
Yes.
It's like, stop, don't move, wait until I figure it out, then we can go.
Isn't that interesting?
It's fascinating.
Yeah, it's just like when you have a nightmare, and you wake up, and you're sitting up in that horrible, frightening moment, and you can't move. It's not that you can't actually move, it's that your brain is stilling you to, so you can assimilate back to being awake and understand what just happened.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Yeah, the human mind is very, very interesting and intricate and interesting, and I like it.
You know, it's absolutely fascinating. And we don't understand even, you know, we really don't understand it. We understand lots about it, but we don't understand everything about it.
We still only understand about, we used to be 10, now it's maybe 12. We still hardly understand our own brain.
Yes. It's amazing.
It's just like our planet. I mean, everybody's all, I want to go to space too, okay? But we have this amazing thing called the oceans of this planet, and we don't know hardly any of it. I think, what did he say, the great British naturalist who does the show Blue Planet?
Oh, David...
Attenborough.
Attenborough, yeah.
He said, we only know, and this shocks me, the oceans are 70% of our planet, right? And we only know about 10% of our oceans, which is 70% of our planet.
Yes.
Wow. Isn't that shocking?
This
day and age, yes, with all LIDAR and radar and all that stuff that we have, and we still don't know our own oceans.
No, no. Which is maybe a good thing. I think once you start to understand it, we'll probably start to destroy it even more. So
yeah,
maybe we need to just leave it alone.
Don't get me started on that one.
No, don't get me started on that one. That's a whole
nother
conversation.
And it's like a whole new show. Do you have any events that are coming up?
So this weekend we've got one in Sydney, which is the New South Wales Writers Centre. Every 2 years they have a speculative fiction weekend, or just one day actually it is, which is really cool. They specialise, each weekend they have a different kind of specialisation, and it's the speculative fiction one this weekend. So we do panels, I'm doing a coffee clutch thing where I sit around and talk to people. I'm on a panel actually, which is going to be really fun, talking about what was our gateway book into the genre. So I'm choosing a horror novel, which is The Shining, Stephen King's The Shining. And for science fiction, I'm going to choose a short story, one of the short stories. My dad had lots of, pardon me, lots of Nebula award-winning anthologies. So I'm going to choose one of those. I've got to go to my bookshelf and pick out one of those. So that's going to be really fun to talk about. We've got two or three others on that panel. We're all going to talk about the books that drew us into the genre and made us realise we were going to be genre writers and readers. And also one about just a basic one about horror and how do you develop horror? How do you scare people? That sort of thing.
Okay, let's see.
That's going to be really fun. There's some of you Canberrans going up for that one. So we're doing a bit of a road trip.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's cool. Now, trying to think about what the things that drew me. The book for science fiction, I think, would be Land by A.E. Van Vogt. And the short story would be I Seen the Body, Electra, from Ray Bradbury.
Oh, yes. Oh, see, I didn't even think. There's so many I could have chosen from. Ray Bradbury is a really good one, too. Maybe I should switch to him. Oh, my gosh. But how do I choose? Like, how do you even choose?
Oh, because Slam was
just because it really was the first real horror novel that I read. I read that when I was in about year 7 or year 8, I think. So that was quite early on when I was being formed as a writer. But maybe Ray Bradbury I should switch to. Oh my gosh.
I met him a couple of times. He was a wonderful man.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was a wonderful man. But I picked Slam because I think I already told you privately, I'm a mystery buff. That was my thing. When I was a kid, Agatha Christie, Ellery Queen, Sherlock Holmes, all those books. And my dad wanted me to diversify, which is really funny because he only read classic science fiction until he was about 65. But anyway, but I think it was that he just wanted to be able to discuss science fiction books with me because I was a fellow reader. So he gave me Slam because it was a female lead in it, and it was a very positive book. And it was,
how thoughtful.
Yeah, and that was my first book. And that was science fiction. And he was very thoughtful on because he knew I hated bug-eyed monsters. I was not into that kind of thing. It scared me. I was a very delicate child. So that's why he picked that. But I just, so that's why that book, it's sort of important to me.
Yeah, right. Yeah, isn't that lovely? I think that's such a thoughtful, that he was so careful in choosing for you.
Yeah, and that it was a girl who was the protagonist. Now I look back, I thought, gee, he was smart.
Yeah, right. That is really, really clever.
Yeah.
And my dad was a bit more random. He just had it all available for me. And just would take me to a library and let me borrow whatever I wanted. I used to borrow James Bond. I love James Bond.
I did too. I love James Bond.
Love.
Does it annoy you when they call it a male series?
Yes.
I get so mad.
Oh, I know.
I've been reading
James Bond. I know. He treated women badly and all the rest of it. But it was so exciting, and I just love the way they were written.
I used my dad used to have those books, and I used to read them. And my dad would let us read whatever books we wanted. He was, you know, totally open about that. And we used to also have a mobile library that used to come to all the neighborhoods. And we used to, when I reached about 9 or 10, I used to get about 4 or 5 children's books. When I reached 10, my dad says, okay, you're ready to graduate to the adult, because this game is ridiculous.
Wasn't he great? What an observant and good person he was.
He was. My father was amazing. He's the smartest man I've ever known still.
Isn't he cool? And gave you so much.
Yeah, yeah. I was very lucky. He was lovely. Well, your father sounds like he was lovely too.
Yes, well, and he's still around, which is really cool, and still reading enormous amounts. He reads 5 or 6 books. So he goes to the library all the time.
Cool.
Reads 5, borrows, you know, 10 books, but he complains. He says, oh, there's only 2 of them that are readable. He'll borrow 10, and he'll say 8 of them are rubbish. absolute rubbish. 2 of them, yeah, maybe 1 or 2 are okay, and 2 of them he likes. So he's still very critical in his reading and in his viewing.
That's good.
Yeah,
that's the way it should be.
He's been a great inspiration. So I talk about him, how he taught himself to. He's Polish, and he came here when he was about 14 with not a word in English, but always loved words, like was totally loved words always, and basically taught himself to English, taught himself to speak and read English using a dictionary that I still have, this dictionary, reading street signs and reading comics.
Oh, that's so great.
Isn't that amazing?
That is really amazing.
So he has an incredible affection for the written word because of that, you know?
Yeah, my grandma on my mom's side was I had a lot of readers in my family. My grandma on my mom's side was a huge reader. She would read anything. And she was Romanian, and she came in I'm half totally Romanian on my mother's side of the family.
Oh, right.
And so she just learned from movies, because it was the 20s and talkies just started.
Right. Wow.
And books. And that's how she learned English, was the talkies and books.
Isn't that amazing?
I know.
Yeah,
I know.
She's all very, very proud. But humans are so, we really are incredibly resourceful and adaptable, aren't we?
It is amazing. It really is. It's really funny. We're coming to the end of the show. I know we love talking.
It goes so quickly.
I know. What do you have a website that people can send you emails to? And also, what social media are you on?
So I'm on Twitter. I'm Karen Warren on Twitter. I'm trying to be reasonably current with that one. And Facebook, I'm on Facebook under my own name as well. Which I just have a public public page for that one. So hopefully I think people can look up and see what I'm up to. I have a website which is karenwarren@wordpress.com, which I am really slack with updating and need to get onto. So I think Twitter's the best way to get in touch with me probably, because I'm on that reasonably often. But I've got a contact area on my WordPress site if people want to send me an email or get in touch about anything whatsoever, or they want to chat about things or ask me questions, that sort of thing.
Cool. Thank you for coming back on the show. I really always enjoy talking to you.
Oh, thanks, Sherry. It's been fantastic. It's inspired me. I always feel like once I talk to you, I just instantly get back to writing.
I'm
very, very inspired when I talk to you.
Good. You inspire me too. It's the mutual thing.
Yes. No, thank you. Thank you so much. And I love hearing all your other conversations. So thank you for making me part of it again.
Thank you. And thank you for chatting with Sherry.
No,